I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, Portland's only community-owned and democratically run radio station. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker, Joe Clement as our engineer. Today is October 31st, in other words, Halloween. Perhaps Halloween is unique among ancient festival days in that Christianity has failed to co-opt it as a religious holiday. The ancient festivals marking spring, rebirth, and fertility, Christians now celebrate as Easter, the resurrection of the Son of God, rather than the rebirth of the sun of warmth and fertility. In festivals marking the winter solstice, when the sun begins its slow return to the northern hemisphere, Christians now celebrate as the birth of the Son of God. Few of us, including Christians, however, will be celebrating All Hallows' Eve, or All Saints' Eve, as it is alternately known. It remains a day, despite the church's efforts, for ghosts, goblins, and witches, and lots of fun. Today on our program, Bill Resnick will be talking with Bill Balterston, an activist involved with the teachers' union in Oakland. They'll be talking about Occupy Oakland, the subsequent police crackdown, and the call for a general strike. Following Bill, I'll be reading an article by Paul Craig Roberts entitled Reckless Endangerment, Totally Corrupt America. This article will go a long way in explaining the why of the Occupy movement. The Old Mole musicologist Brad Duncan is with us today. Joe Clement will be talking with him about prison songs regarding death row inmates and the persistence of capital punishment, a timely subject given the recent governmental murder of Troy Davis after new evidence and testimony exposed the probability of his innocence. Following that, Movie Mole's Denise Morris and Laurie Mercier will be reviewing the Black Power mixtape currently playing at Cinema 21 through this coming Thursday. But now here's Bill Resnick talking with Bill Balterston down in Oakland, California.
Bill Balterston, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you, Bill. It's a great pleasure to have a chance to share some of the very exciting moments that are occurring here in Oakland.
Bill Balderston's a long-term Oakland activist. He's written on the history of the very militant union movement in Oakland. He's a leader of the Oakland Educational Association, and he's now involved in Occupy Oakland. Bill, the unions of Portland and others have called for a general strike in support of Occupy Oakland. Tell us why.
Well, I think that it's something that has struck a nerve throughout the country. A lot of people would like to portray the Occupy movement as something which is, you know, on the margins or those who are simply disenchanted. And certainly it's never been that to begin with. But to the extent that it reflects the overall interest of working people in this country, I think what's happening in Oakland now is a example of the fact that organized labor, which has been vilified in recent years, for many years actually, and especially the public sector workers, understand that unless we listen to the demands and the outcry of the community, and especially young people who have been robbed of their future, that our future collectively is going nowhere. And right now, a wide range of unions have hearkened to the call that emanated from a large gathering of people who had come to the Occupy Oakland site the day after massive police repression occurred and heard the demand, the request, the frustration in response to this and called for a general strike. It's not a general strike, perhaps, in the sense that some people know or even read about in Greece or France, where the union leaderships decide to pull everybody out. It's a strike of the community in which many, not all admittedly, but many of the key unions are solidarizing ourselves with the community and with the youth. My union, the Oakland Education Association, has put out a call to all our members, hoping that at the very least And some schools will be completely closed. Those who are not completely closed will have the vast majority out on personal leave. And we are working with other unions to try to make this sort of an effective action.
Yeah, students are also, though, have in the past in Oakland, the recent past, gone out and made demands and protested. They'll be there, I gather, what is it, Wednesday?
Right. Well, yes, there's a recent history of even where it was simply labeled as a strike, of mass mobilizations in the East Bay to show solidarity, whether it be with Palestine, whether it be with Mumia Abu-Jamal. We had a massive, my union had an all-day action, as did the ILWU, which I'll get to in a second, the longshore workers, in support of Mumia.
And also, of course, in support, protest against the Oscar Grant case. The way
right.
That went,
and in terms of the Oscar Grant case, again, we've had significant support to demand that this kind of mindless and racist violence come to a halt.
Yeah. Tell us about the ILWU. Let's talk about the ILWU.
The ILWU, of course, it has locals, including in Portland and in Seattle, but its home base, of course, was originally San Francisco, and it harkens back to the 1934 general strike. It's a union that has always been defined by militancy, including the demand that there be full rights for all its members, especially people of color. And the ILWU has closed the port on a number of key moments. You can go back to the struggle around South Africa and the fact that they, on a number of occasions, refused to unload ships that were taking materials to apartheid South Africa. They received an especially warm statement later from Nelson Mandela once he was freed for that kind of international solidarity. And they've done this on other occasions, as I said before, and they're ready to shut the port down for Wednesday. So we, you know, we are emboldened by that. We're hoping that other unions, so one of the key SEIU unions and the hotel and restaurant workers, and of course one of the bastions of militancy here, the California Nurses Association, which is headquartered in Oakland and has led many fights on single payer health care and independent political action and a wide range of other issues, will be involved as well.
Well, the saying goes, Oakland is a union town. It's also a black city. The black movement is fractionated, though a lot of the younger, more radical black kids are now identifying with Occupy Oakland. That's my understanding.
Right. Well, I think both African-American and Latino students have had to face continual harassment even before this current economic crisis. You mentioned the Oscar Grant case before. I mean, that the reason the response to that was so dynamic or so motivated by anger was because it wasn't just protesting the killing of one person, as outrageous as that was, but the experiences people have gone through for years and years and years. I taught in East Oakland for decades where my students faced this kind of harassment. So the episode that happened last week was no surprise to young people who've undergone it for a long time. Nonetheless, it shocked not only much of the Oakland community and the labor movement, but much of the country and the world.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety. We're talking to Bill Balderston. He's a longtime activist, a leader of the Oakland Educational Association. He's now deeply involved in Occupy Oakland. We've been talking about the general strike that was called. They call it a general strike. It really is a walkout and a huge protest movement. Many of the unions, like the ILWU and the teachers, are involved in it and will be taking actions that slow down at least the business of Oakland. It's not actually, though, a general strike of the kind in 1934 and even 1946 in Oakland, in that it's not as if the city is really shut down, and it's not as if the working people have decided to take over the city and run it as a city. After all, the hospitals have to keep going. The food has to be delivered. City workers can't stop the waterworks, but they're in fact running it themselves and running the city. That's not the kind of general strike that this is. On the other hand, the Occupy Oakland movement has some of the features of a general strike in that it's sort of highly democratic, self-managed from below. The general assemblies and the working groups are really interesting bodies and very active. It seems to me there's... Tell us about the general assemblies and the way...
Well, the general assemblies...
And the way that Occupied Oakland operates. It sort of changed over time, I understand.
Right. Admittedly, it was somewhat delayed in terms of its initiation compared to New York and some of the other places, although there people had been organizing for some time in the Bay Area. There was an Occupy San Francisco that began slightly earlier at the Federal Reserve Bank and then spread to Oakland. Initially, the group that was there were mainly young people, but were joined by a large number of the homeless. And while this might sound as though it wouldn't be an easy mix, the fact is that people began to work together quite effectively, to the extent that the city tried to, and the press, of course, tried to play on, some of the problems in terms of sanitation and all that.
That's happening in Portland, too.
It's disingenuous. I mean, because people were progressively improving the situation. There was a child center. There was a library. There was, of course, a kitchen and medical tent. There was the creation of a kind of model that, is something that I think we could all feel is a kind of communal institution that we would like to see develop. Obviously, there weren't the resources or the opportunity to expand massively on this. But many of us thought that the city, headed by a mayor who is ostensibly a left liberal, should have said, "Look, this is a very positive thing. We'll support these programs. We'll contribute to these programs." And instead, at best, she waffled, and then last week she was certainly responsible. No matter who actually gave the order for these attacks, she was responsible for what happened. As regards the General Assemblies, again, they were meeting daily, every night, and I think there was some exclusivity early on, but they were expanding to hear the voices of others. And then, of course, the police brought at least a temporary end to that. And what emerged was something even more dynamic. There have been meetings of 500 to 800 people on a daily basis to discuss issues. And the meeting that led to the call for the general strike was initially 3,000 people. And when the number had to leave, but eventually when the vote came, there was well over 1,500 people who voted, and 93% or 94% voted in favor of calling for a general strike. And it was, again, taken very seriously by the labor movement in the community. This was not just a small room of lefties, debating what they would like to see.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole, talking to Bill Balderston, very active in the Occupied Oakland movement that called for what they call a general strike. It's really not quite that. It's a huge mass action with lots of people actually laying down their tools and books and coming to the mass action this coming Wednesday. Bill, you called it probably it's going to be the greatest mobilization in Oakland in modern times. That's what you're expecting. We'll be looking at it. Let's go back to the General Assemblies and the working groups that have come out of Occupied Oakland. my understanding is that it's very interesting that there really are substantive discussions about the kinds of world people want to live in and the sort of reforms that they want to demand, that they are demanding. And some of those reforms are not just the usual ones. Many of the usual ones are, of course, substantive and important. But there's a lot of kind of radical reform, a real democratization sort of spirit to what they're doing, anticipating that other better necessary world. Tell us about the working groups and the General Assembly and the kinds of discussions that are going on.
Well, again, I mean, one of the common criticisms overall of the Occupy movement is that they don't have any focus, they don't have demands. Well, I don't think that's true. I think clearly there's been a desire to perhaps avoid things that will divide the movement. But as far as Oakland goes, I'm sure in other places, there are certain issues that are absolutely critical. So around, for example, public education, which is my bailiwick, there's all sorts of discussions about sort of labor and community control of the schools. There's major resistance on just countless levels, everything from the way the schools are being manipulated around resources to what the goals of public education should be. And of course, this is one, if not the major political football that we've seen tossed around in recent years, and people are responding to that, both students and educators. There's certainly demands around how to limit the kind of repressive role that we saw not only this week, but as I said before, in an ongoing way with the police in terms of community control of the police. There's, a range of issues. People are talking about how to get universal health care, single-payer health care. So it's not that these issues are not emerging. They're not as such litmus tests for people. But the point of discussion is to how to organize. Again, I'm not sure Oakland is an exception or not, but we have a wide range of people and experiences that have engaged in this. And, everyone, I think, is willing to learn from each other. A lot of us have traditional ways of going about these things, and I think this has been an eye-opening experience in terms of real participatory democracy, where people, as I said, in groups of hundreds can actually have a sense of participation, and yet also understand that as important as that internal structure is, they have to relate to forces outside of the Occupy encampment. So it's this general strike is symbolic of the fact that this movement, I think, is finding new ways to move its ethos, its sense of justice forward, and opposing the evils of the kind of financial and economic system that we've seen really decimate not just the labor movement, but our whole country.
Yeah, Bill, we've got into the sort of the economic questions of taxation, investment, takeover investment, some kinds of state banks. I gather that those ideas are now being discussed by a really wide range of people within occupied Oakland.
Well, certainly the idea of tax the rich is one of the dominant themes, and people are ready to work on concrete ideas around that. There are quite a few Green Party activists who have floated the idea of a state bank that would be used to create jobs and social investment. People know that there is a material basis that's necessary to create an alternative society, and there are active points that people are discussing.
Bill Balderston, thanks so much for talking to us. Keep up the good work. I hope it is one of the greatest mobilizations in Oakland and carries on further. Thanks a lot for your work and talking to us today.
Thank you very much, Bill.
I saw a werewolf with a Chinese menu in his hand, walking through the streets of Soho in the rain. He was looking for the place called Lee.
get a big dish of beef chow mein. Ah-hoo, where was London? Ah-hoo.
Zevon, high on everyone's list of favorite songs to play at Halloween. Today I'm going to share with you an article which explains exactly why the Wall Street occupiers and the occupiers of other locales too numerous to mention, including, of course, Oakland and here in Portland, are so fired up and angry. The article is entitled Reckless Endangerment, Totally Corrupt America, by Paul Craig Roberts. Roberts is a former editor of the Wall Street Journal and an assistant secretary of the U.S. Treasury under the Reagan administration. As you will see, Roberts has had a change of heart since those bad old days. Financial crisis, which is very much still with us, Roberts begins, did not result from accident or miscalculation. Neither did it result because of the law flaw in Alan Greenspan's theory, as he told Congress when a feeble effort was made to hold him accountable. It was the intentional result of people motivated by short-term profits who wanted to get theirs and get out. Fraud characterized every stage of the process, from the fraudulent borrower incomes and credit scores that mortgage issuers gave to unqualified buyers, through the securitization of the mortgages and their AAA investment grade ratings by the rating agencies, Standard & Poor's especially, but also Moody's and Fitch, to the investment banks that sold what the banks knew was junk to investors around the world as investment grade securities. Indeed, Goldman Sachs was simultaneously betting against the mortgage derivatives that it was selling to clients. Investment banks such as Goldman Sachs, which once considered it a matter of honor to represent the interests of customers, took advantage of the trust that had been built up in the past to commit fraud against customers in order to advance the bank's short-term profits and the outsized multimillion dollar managerial bonuses that these fraudulent profits produced. Those benefiting from fraud were able to defeat laws that were passed that would have held them to account. For example, the state of Georgia passed perfect legislation that held predatory lending to account. William J. Brennan Jr. and Georgia Governor Roy E. Barnes got the Georgia regulators to throw in the towel. The state laws would have prevented the worst part of the financial crisis, if not prevented the crisis altogether. The Georgia law only lasted a few months, because the rating agencies saw that their enormous profits from issuing fraudulent investment-grade ratings were threatened by the law. The corrupt rating agencies mischaracterized the Consumer Protection Act as a jihad by regulators. Standard & Poor's declared that it could no longer allow Georgia's mortgages to be placed in mortgage securities that are rated. In other words, Georgia mortgages could no longer be securitized. This announcement banned Georgia mortgage lenders from securitization. Thus, the law was overturned, and fraud ran wild. These kind of mafia strong-arm tactics in order to protect at all costs the short-term mega-bonuses that drove the totally fraudulent system have never been held accountable or punished. Totally innocent people are held indefinitely and tortured by the U.S. government for no other reason than to convince the global public that they are endangered by terrorists. But those who wiped out the home ownership and retirement pensions of millions of Americans now hold high and honorable positions on corporate boards and U.S. regulatory agencies. Federal regulatory agencies totally failed. Brooks Lieborn tried to use her statutory authority to regulate over-the-counter derivatives, but she was blocked by the Federal Reserve Chairman, the U.S. Treasury Secretary, and the SEC Chairman, and she was forced to resign. As University of Chicago Nobel economist George Stigler predicted, regulatory agencies are captured by those who are intended to be regulated. This was the case. Regulators turned a blind eye to obvious criminal fraud and rewarded with lucrative positions in the financial community. The same for U.S. senators and representatives who repealed Glass-Steagall and other financial regulations. For example, former U.S. Senator Phil Gramm, who spearheaded the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act, which separated commercial from investment banking, the repeal of which set up the financial crisis, was rewarded by being made vice chairman of a megabank, UBS, a Swiss global financial service company. What is clear is that while monster criminals continue to collect their multimillion dollar annual incomes, depressed single mothers are sent to prison for having small quantities of illegal drugs to boost their depressed spirits, and their children are put out to adoption. This is justice in America. That was an article by Paul Craig Roberts. Roberts is an editor of the Wall Street Journal and an assistant secretary of the U.S. Treasury. His latest book, How the Economy is Lost, has just been published by Counterpunch/AK Press. And again, this is KBOO 90.7 FM Portland and the Old Mole Variety Hour. Now Joe Clement talks with Old Mole musicologist Brad Duncan. Their subject today is capital punishment.
Good morning. I'm joined here with our radical musicologist Brad Duncan in Philadelphia, here to talk about some music surrounding the death penalty and the experience of being on death row. Good morning, Brad.
Good morning, Joe. How are you?
I'm doing great. So we had made the selection somewhat with Troy Davis in mind, and I was wondering whether we could just jump into Myrtle Haggard's song, which is, you know, really kind of told from the perspective of one of these guys on death row and how he feels about his life coming to an end. And so I'd just like to take a minute for us to go ahead and listen to this clip that you had selected from Myrtle Haggard's Sing Me Back Home.
The warden led a prisoner down the hallway to his doom. And I stood up to say goodbye like all the rest. And I heard him tell the warden just before he reached my cell, let my guitar play in friend my request. Let him sing me back home for the song I used to hear. Make my old memories come alive. Take me away and turn back the years. Sing me back home before I die.
So that was Myrtle Haggard singing Sing Me Back Home Before I Die. And I'm joined here with Brad Duncan to talk about this death penalty-related music. So why don't you tell us a little bit about who Myrtle Haggard is?
Myrtle Haggard, who is still alive and still recording music, grew up in Southern California during the Depression, and his parents were part of the really incredible community of people in what's then called the Dust Bowl, the plains of the U.S. forced out during the Depression. And he really was kind of in and out of prison and juvenile detention facilities from his youth, ended up making a really incredible impact on country music in the 60s and 70s, thought of as being one of the founders of what was called outlaw country, along with Willie Nelson and others. And that song that we heard is from 1967, and it is an absolutely powerful song, in my opinion. And it really, I think, one of the tremendous things that it does is humanizes, in a very unadorned and simple way, humanizes this person who's about to be murdered by the state. There's no sense of moral judgment. There's no sense of even the discussion of whether he's guilty or not. It's simply that this is a human being that's going to die. And in asking to hear this song before they die, this gospel song that brings back all of these memories of, you know, their childhood and really their whole life, I think it's very powerful. And it really stands in contrast to how people on death row and prisoners in general were thought of back both in 1967 and in 2011. And I think it's a really elegant defense of humanity on the issue of this execution. It's really one of Merle Haggard's best songs.
Right, and I like the way that in, you know, asking to have these memories drummed up for him again, he's not, like you said, really objecting to his being on death row, although he doesn't say anything about it, but he's kind of pleading for a certain amount of dignity if he has to die, and that he kind of makes a nod to the fact that having been on death row has been this dehumanizing experience already, and that that only makes the of dying that much more unbearable.
I think all of that nuance and really sensitivity to the situation is something that he was able to bring to bear in that song. It's pretty remarkable for that reason.
Well, I would like to turn to another song which you had suggested we listen to, and that is Steve Earle's Ellis Unit 1. Why don't you just tell us a little bit about Steve Earle before we listen to that clip?
Well, Steve Earle is another very iconic figure in American country and roots music, and he's another person who also spent time in prison, much like Merle Haggard. Steve Earle, actually, before he would become known as a country and rock performer later in the 1980s, worked in a prison, worked on death row in a prison in his native Texas, and then later in the early 90s was in prison on drug charges himself. And all the time since he's been released from prison, so really from the mid-90s to now, he's been a prolific musician and also a really prolific anti-death penalty activist. So let's take a listen to this remarkable song, which is, he's got a number of songs on the death penalty, and this is just the most powerful, Ellis Unit 1.
Well, my daddy used to talk about them long nights at the walls, and how they used to strap on in the chair. Kids down from the college, and they'd bring their beer and all. And when the lights went out, the cheer rose in the air. Folks just got too civilized. Spark is gathering dust. 'Cause no one wants to touch a smoking gun. They got the injection, they don't mind as much, I guess. They just put them down at Ellis Unit 1. Swing, swing, Lord, and carry me home.
So that was Steve Earle singing, or a selection from his Ellis Unit 1, and I'm here talking with Brad Duncan. One of the things that I really kind of liked about what came out in that clip was the distinction between the way we used to do the death penalty and the way that we do now, and how there was kind of a built-in resistance to it, just in the fact that it used to be so gruesome, and now it's, you know, much more, we call it humane, but it's really kind of humane for the viewers and the executioners more than the person who still dies.
Yeah, indeed. And I think that's really one of the most insightful aspects of that song. And because, you know, he was saying that people used to, some people would revel in it, including college kids who would come out to the prison life, you know, much like they used to do for lynchings. 100 years before that, you know, there was a spectacle around it. And he really very deftly makes the point that just because they've eliminated some of the spectacle, it's really only made it easier for society to kind of swallow this idea of state murder. And there's, I wouldn't say a cynicism, but there's a knowing to how he phrases that, having really seen it both ways. You know, as he said, his father worked in the same prison, his uncles worked in the same prison, and he really, it's a vivid image of both how the death penalty was and is now. And that song, there's a lot of things going on in that song that's really remarkable. It actually first appeared on the soundtrack to the film Dead Man Walking from the mid-1990s. Also about the death penalty, and it's remarkable for the way that it talks about how different people close to the situation reacted to it. You know, there's both reflection on how the people taking him down the hall responded to it. There's both the victim's family who, in many cases, would watch it. There's, you know, I've seen them go like lions, and I've seen them go like lambs. I mean, it's just, it's such a really kind of horrifyingly intimate look inside the death chamber and inside death row. And I think in many ways it humanizes the forces involved, you know, in different ways, much like the Merle Haggard song did, at least for the person being executed and Prisoners. But I really think the Steve Earle song is just so much richer. It's such a richer song because of the way he kind of turns over these stones. For example, looking at how, you know, maybe we think about executions differently because they're not as, they don't seem as visceral as they would have in the 60s with the electric chair and such. And it's a really probing and deeply thoughtful song. And as I mentioned before, Steve Earle is intimately involved with anti-death penalty activism. And also, I should also mention, he's not just an anti-death penalty activist. He's also intimately involved with efforts to support the labor movement, definitely was supportive of the uprising in Wisconsin. So Steve Earle is really an all-around mensch of the working class. But I really think this is ultimately, for someone with a remarkable history of songwriting and really vivid, almost uncomfortably vivid lyrics sometimes, I think Hillis Unit 1 is really one of Steve Earle's finest achievements.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. My name's Joe Clement. I've been talking with Brad Duncan, our radical musicologist, about music of the death penalty. We heard clips from Steve Earle's Ellis Unit 1 and Merle Haggard's Singing Me Back Home.
Well, thanks again, Joe and Old Moles. I'll be back soon with more radical musicology.
And this is the Old Mole Variety Hour. Now Movie Moles Laurie Mercier and Denise Morris recollect the heady days of the Black Panthers and the Black Panther movement, or the Black Power movement, I should say, of the late 60s and early 70s. They'll be talking about a film now playing in Cinema 21 entitled The Black Power Mixtape.
Thanks, Tom. Yeah, we are talking about the Black Power Mixtape, 1967 to 1975, and it opened this past Friday at Cinema 21 here in Portland, and it plays through Thursday of this week. This documentary was developed from archival footage found stored in the basement of Swedish television for more than 30 years. And Swedish documentary filmmaker Göran Hugo Olsson discovered the footage while doing research for another documentary project. These hundreds of hours of archival footage of the American Black Power movement was shot by a Swedish news crew in the 60s and 1970s and was intended to air on Swedish television as a multi-part series spanning nearly 10 years. It's really unclear how much of the footage was ever aired. Some say none, and some say that some of it actually did find its way on the airwaves. But after finding backers to support the making or the remaking of the film, Göran Olsson made the Black Power Mixtape, 1967 to 1975. And the film combines music and contemporary audio interviews from leading African-American artists, activists, musicians, and scholars with this rare and mostly unseen 16-millimeter footage. Some of the folks that participate in the film or are in the film during the original filming, you had Stokely Carmichael, Martin Luther King, Eldridge Cleaver, Bobby Seale, Huey Newton, Angela Davis, Kathleen Cleaver, Sonia Sanchez. Actually, she does a narration. There's a commentary, I mean, throughout the film, folks looking back. You have folks even like Erykah Badu and some others, popular musicians and poets who participate. So it's quite a project and an undertaking. Backers were also including Danny Glover and his partner in production, Jocelyn Barnes. So some good folks all around. Laurie, we are going to try to unpack this a little bit. It's a film that's being talked about quite a lot from different perspectives. But what I think is interesting, and maybe an interesting place to start, is just this footage, you know, found in a basement after 30 years, is compiled. And it's particularly from the perspective of the Swedish journalists who found themselves connected to what was happening in the United States around race and around the emerging Black Power movement and civil rights movement, motivated particularly by the horrors of the Vietnam War and America's participation in it.
And I think that's what makes this film so fascinating to us as American viewers and as progressive leftist viewers, that aside from the raw footage of some of the personalities and ordinary scenes from Black Power America, is this obvious outsider view, which at times is quite naive, but at other times very clear, that the Swedish journalists are eliciting different kinds of responses from many of the Black Power personalities of the time, Angela Davis, Stokely Carmichael, that they're responses are quite different from anything we've seen. And I think that it's very clear that the Swedish journalists ask different questions and point the camera in a more sympathetic way than any documentary footage that we've seen coming out of this country. And when I asked, or when Olsen has been asked about this coverage, it's clear that he wants to emphasize that this is not a film about the Black Power movement, but about how Sweden interpreted the movement.
Yeah, I think that's a really important distinction, because the way that we might want to critique the film for doing or not doing certain things is through the lens of having the director be the filmmaker and the creator or gatherer of those images. But really what ends up occurring with this film is that this footage was created there. And the use of the term mixtape, it has its own specific history in terms of its relationship to the emergence of rap music in the 70s, but that would be a lot to get into at the moment. But at any rate, it's sort of a more interesting term to use than, say, remake or even reconstruct. But that this, I think that if viewers can have both a kind of dual experience, one is to have the ability to see this rare footage and this rare documentation of some of the kind of ongoings of the emerging movement, people who traveled to Sweden, like Stokely Carmichael, to speak, and speeches that they gave. I mean, it's fabulous. But it is, as you say, it really is, in many ways, a reflection on what was going on for the Swedish journalists as they were making this film and what appealed to them.
And I think that is another, that international dimension is something that's missing from much of what has been filmed about the Black Panthers, the Black Power Movement, SNCC, and other critical militant groups and movements at in the mid to late 1960s. And there is this very compelling scene in the film where the Swedish journalist is trying to get Stokely Carmichael's mother to say something about her experiences in the United States. And Carmichael takes over the interview. And one senses that this would not have happened with American journalists working on this theme, that the Swedish journalists were much more open for these activists to shape the narrative that was coming out. So it really was much more like oral history or cinema verite, that the activists themselves were helping to shape the narrative that was going over the Swedish airwaves, which was certainly unlike anything happening in the United States and what Americans saw coming out of this movement, which was either demonized by the mainstream media or lionized, or the iconography or icons created by many on the left in this country. So that kind of humanizing of many of these main actors, I thought, was quite compelling in this documentary footage.
Right, and this particular piece that you mentioned with Stokely Carmichael and his mother was the initial interview that was set up. He had actually met the interviewer, and her name's not coming to me, but there's an article in the New York Times in which she's interviewed and talks about going, then after she had met him, going to the U.S. to interview him, and that she was finding herself having trouble getting Mabel, his mother, to sort of speak. And then he, as you say, comes in and sort of takes the interview in the way that it's great. I mean, you would never see anything like that, nor would you have seen a news report by an American journalist who talked about Angela Davis in quite the way that she's talking about her case when she was arrested for, accused of being involved in the murder of George Jackson. And at any rate, he talks about how smart she was and how her people came forward, her professors and people who knew her came forward and said what a wonderful person she was. And you're like, that would not have happened on American television.
Well, her critique of this notion of violence that had been leveled at Black militants throughout this period, and that she takes that on, and the Swedish journalists, of course, are very sympathetic to that view.
Right, and somewhat naive in the questions that they ask. And this clip that we're going to play for folks, it's a couple minutes, but I think it's really worth playing in its total. And I encourage people to see the film because then they will actually get to see some of the lovely contrasting of the teal blue walls of her prison area where she's being interviewed and just this sort of magnificent, there's an aesthetic quality to this whole piece that I would think people would want to see. But the interviewer raises this question, you know, do you approve of violence? And we get into the clip just as she's beginning to answer that question.
Yeah, but the question is more, how do you get there? Do you get there by confrontation, violence?
Oh, is that the question you were asking?
Yeah.
You asked me, you know, whether I approve of violence. I mean, that just doesn't make any sense at all. Whether I approve of guns. I grew up in Birmingham, Alabama. Some very, very good friends of mine were killed by bombs, bombs that were planted by racists. I remember from the time I was very small, I remember the sounds of bombs exploding across the street, our house shaking. I remember my father having to have guns at his disposal at all times because of the fact that at any moment someone, we might expect to be attacked. The man who was at that time in complete control of the city government, his name was Bull Connor, would often get on the radio and make statements like, niggers have moved into a white neighborhood, we better expect some bloodshed tonight. And sure enough, there would be bloodshed. After the four young girls who lived, one of them lived next door to me. I was very good friends with the sister of another one. My sister was very good friends with all three of them. My mother taught one of them in her class. My mother, in fact, when the bombing occurred, one of the mothers of one of the young girls called my mother and said, can you take me down to the church to pick up Carol? We heard about the bombing, and I don't have my car. And they went down, and what did they find? They found limbs and heads strewn all over the place. And then after that, in my neighborhood, all of the men organized themselves into an armed patrol. They had to take their guns and patrol our community every night because they did not want that to happen again. I mean, that's why when someone asked me about violence, I just find it incredible. What it means is that the person who's asking that question has absolutely no idea what black people have gone through, what black people have experienced in this country since the time the first black person was kidnapped from the shores of Africa.
So, Denise, I think that's a great example of those moments in the film that are more like oral history where the journalists allow activists like Angela Davis to take charge of shaping the story. And I suppose what I find disappointing about the film, my only major criticism really, is the last part of the film where filmmaker Olson, of course, as the documentarian, makes selections and pieces together a narrative, although we sometimes forget there's a narrative or thesis watching these documentary clips. Nonetheless, by the 1970s, the message is pretty clear that the movement falls apart, mostly due to the drugs that infiltrate black communities across the country. And I had a bit of a problem with that kind of narrative that, of course, seemed to ignore the police brutality, the COINTELPRO program of repression, the jailing, the killing of so many Black Panther and Black Power movement leaders, those in exile. That seems to limit the end of the film in particular. And of course, history is not kind to movements because we tend to focus on the failures and the disillusion of them. But what did you think about the end of the film and the omissions that seem to be present?
Right. I think you're right in both saying that history is not kind to movements, and history was probably not kind to the Swedish television crew either, because they began to have issues, they began to have conflicts with the U.S. and with having the kinds of access that they had previously had. And in fact, as the Vietnam War came to a close, it may have created a certain or an uncertainty about how to move forward in what they may want to focus, where these movements were going. But I think you point to definitely a problem with the film in terms of it not really making broader connections in the way that a film like All Power to the People, which we're going to link to on our website, but a film like that, which deeply explores these movements in a two-hour documentary, but in this collection, the commentary, I think, is where there was sort of a failure to make connections between these movements past and these movements present, and past meaning what happened after 1975, where are we now, and how can we talk about those movements more in terms of the activism and the legacy and all of that stuff. So I think in some sense the commentary that was used, the contemporary commentary, was not so effective.
In that individuals were talking about how Black power influenced them as individuals, but not how it transformed society in important ways or led to the evolution of other kinds of movement, like the movements like the Revolutionary Black Workers in Detroit or the Third World Women's Alliance. Mm-hmm. But we do want to encourage our listeners to go see this film, Black Power Mixtape, at Cinema 21, where it will be playing through Thursday.
Thursday, yeah. And this is the Old Mole Variety Hour. It's Denise Morris with Laurie Mercier. And we'll have some good links on the website people can check out as well.
I was working in the lab late one night when my eyes beheld an eerie sight, for my monster from his slab began to rise, and suddenly, to my surprise,
he did the mash.
He did the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
He did the mash.
It caught on in a flash.
He did the mash.
He did the monster mash. From my laboratory in the castle east to the master bedroom where the vampires feast, the ghouls all came from their humble abode to get a jolt from my electrode.
They did the mash.
They did the monster mash.
The monster mash.
That was, of course, The Monster Mash by Bobby Boris Pickett and the Crypt Kickers. Number one, always number one on the Halloween hit list. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Joe Clement is our engineer. That completes our program for today. Every Monday, the Old Mole brings you an hour of political, social, and cultural commentary from the mole's point of view. That is, from the ground up. As moles, we seek to explore alternative possibilities for our cultural, social, and political lives that move beyond the hegemony of unfettered global capitalism and a culture of consumerism, exploitation, and environmental devastation. We agitate for a new order in which all humankind lead fulfilling lives with an ecologically sustainable environment. From the mole's perspective, such effective change can only come about through grassroots democratic struggles that chip away at existing power structures in an effort to create more just and equitable communities, both locally and internationally. So tune in next Monday for more interviews, reviews, music, and commentaries that reflect the Old Mole mission. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. Our program today will be podcast on the KBOO website in the next day or two. You can either listen to the entire program or specific segments. You can also find links to more information about guests and topics, as well as past programs. Just go to our webpage at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour.